Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, simply everything you can possibly think of, has its own history, like patios, agility, and berets.
Oh, I love... Should we do berets? We've done hats, haven't we? But we should do berets in particular.
I met the father of one of my son's friends, arrived at a kind of a family meal just the other week, wearing the most fantastic beret. So I'm all inspired by them. It was a nice wool one, very stylish. And I think we should find out more about the history of berets.
Do you have a beret, completely. Sam Willis?
I've got an orange... Well, there is one in the house. I wouldn't say that I have one.
But there is one in the Willis residence.
Yes, I inherited from my granny, who used to wear them a lot.
Oh, nice. I think we have a red dress-up one.
Or
we could do sprouts, pouts and louts, clouts, doubts and flouts. I love the idea of doing pouts and flouts. Flouts is all about rule-breaking, and pouting is about... I don't know what pouting is about. We should explore that. However...
Moods.
Moods, yes. Moody teenagers. However, for the moment, we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, that the history of mothers, this is one of my favourites of all time, is in fact all about Freud's controversial Oedipus complex. It's about the archaeological site of Banpo in China, discovered in 1953. It's also all about medals for motherhood, the Cross of Honour handed out to mothers in Nazi Germany, Stalin's Order of Maternal Glory, and it's also all about maternal conflict and violence in the Paston letters, all the way through to 17th century diary extracts of a worried mother, Lady Anne Clifford. Or, who knew that the history of divorce is in fact all about Henry VIII's divorce from Catherine of Aragon, the roles played by Wolsey, Cromwell and Cranmer before analysing the Reformation Parliament and the break for Rome. Of course, that is one of our brilliant homeschooling episodes.
And they were very good, those homeschooling ones. So I do go back and listen to the back catalogue and check those out. Let me introduce my fellow presenter. This one got a bit confused, James. You'll have to bear with me. If history were a hand, soft and smooth or gnarled and callous, this man would be both hand surgeon and manicurist, carefully shaping the cuticles of the past, mending any cracked phalanges, allowing that hand the full scale of movement required to make gestures and signs, to hold pens to type, so that the historical hand could communicate with the eyes and ears of eager students in the present. But more importantly... so that the hand could proudly wear the most exquisite jewellery in the form of rings. No doubt, if it is an old and English ring, then the diamond on top would have been stolen from the mines of India. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. And you may well be wondering who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode. Well, this is a mangled monster, if ever there was one. Let's just say that if he were a jewellery-related historian, he'd only be the king of bling, festooned with gold chains and swagger. His rep in the historical rap game is legend, his powers of archival recovery worthy of diamonds and pearls. He ain't no Ratner's ripoff. He's the real deal Mac Daddy of the past. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, hello, hello.
Do you like being the real Mac Daddy of the past?
Yes, I do. The big Mac Daddy.
Yes.
When I wrote my introduction, I came back to it and I realised that actually I'd written an introduction to the history of the hand.
I didn't know quite what I was doing at all.
Please listen to our podcast on the history of the hand because it's fascinating.
Yes. I don't know why I have got lots of rap and hip hop here, except that I went to a terrific dinner at a friend's house and got a schooling of old school hip hop. Have you ever come across a group called The Roots? I had not. The Roots are extraordinary. So go to wherever you find your downloads from music and check out The Roots. And also an album called Jazzmatazz, which is the guru, the guy who was in Gangstar, went off and rediscovered all of these sort of legendary jazz musicians and then put them to hip-hop. It is the most brilliant album I've heard in ages. Anyway, that is a total kind of segue away from what we're talking about.
It's kind of not, because if you think about all of the hip-hop artists and their jewellery, and because what they wore was a really important part of cultural identity in the, you know, 80s, early 90s. Is that what we're talking about here? And there's a great example there of how jewellery can be used to define social movements.
Ooh, very good. I remember having a VW badge on a rope. I didn't steal it, but a friend did, and I wore it as a sort of totem when I was 15 years old, 14 years
very
old,
good.
Slightly square teenager, trying to get a rep wearing. That was the Beastie Boys symbol at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder why. Why do they go for the VW? That's weird, isn't it?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Like a German car manufacturer.
But it actually transformed the way. That was a time when you could pull out those little insignias, those badges from the front of VWs. And what this meant was, in order to stop them being nicked, VW sort of just built them in so that you couldn't actually pull them out. They were built into the bonnet after that. The influence of the Beastie Boys. But we are talking about jewellery because Joanna, our intern, our work experience student from Plimpton Academy, came up with this idea and did some research for us. And so this has been what has really sort of inspired us to do something around the history of jewellery. So, Sam, if you were thinking about the history of jewellery, where would your starting point be?
Well, I would immediately think about my own kind of interaction with historical jewellery. Have you ever sort of handled or seen some really amazing historical jewellery?
I've seen it, not handled it, but I imagine you've. Okay. I imagine you've handled all sorts of historical jewels.
Yes, it's amazing how making TV programmes allows curators let you break the rules. particularly jewellery from the Armada. The Spanish Armada. So in various Irish museums, they have them because the ships sank off the north coast of Ireland, wrecks being discovered, and they've managed to raise some of the jewellery and look after it. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to get hold of some of that stuff, particularly the gold chains.
Mm.
Single gold chains, but they're about, 10 foot long, maybe longer. And so you wear them around and around and around and around your neck in the kind of Mr. T style. A couple of beautiful salamanders. And this is, of course, is gold and jewels, which came from South America. Lots of rubies, particularly emeralds, very interesting. So not so much diamonds. Diamonds is going to be something I'll talk about later. But diamonds, they have a provenance, or basically all of the diamonds in the world came from India before they were discovered in Brazil in about the 17th century. So if you're talking about jewellery from the Spanish, then you've got to think about empire, you've got to think about South America. And their access to the silver, the gold, and the rubies and the emeralds primarily. So that's why the colours of the Armada jewellery, if you search up Armada jewellery, are as they were. So I immediately thought about that. And then, I'm going to be kind of exploring themes about how you get hold of the precious stones required for kind of exquisite jewellery, royalty particularly, extremely high status jewellery. So the ones that survived from the Armada came from incredibly wealthy Catholic people who were bringing their wealth with them to England. They were fully expecting to land and stay. And so portable wealth was another way of thinking about it as well. And also, so many of that jewellery is religious. So there is definitely a spiritual, almost kind of magical element to the use of jewellery there. So that was my initial thoughts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewellery from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, very good. I've just Googled the Armada jewellery. Quite extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. And one of the things that I was thinking about was, I mean, there are different ways of thinking about jewellery. So you can think about it in terms of, as we were talking about with the rap and hip-hop crews, you know, you've got jewellery there that is about status. It's about bling. It's about showing the wealth that you are, your importance, your value. But also you can think about jewellery in other different ways. So it's not so much about display of somebody's rank or status. It has spiritual properties. And I think looking at jewelries as amulets or as totems or as powerful charms, I think, is really, really interesting. Things that are worn on the person to avert evil and to advance prosperity. And this is something that you can trace all the way back to ancient Egypt, for example. You can look at the way in which the physician Galen used amulets for almost sort of medical purposes to protect people. But I've come across some really interesting examples of these. There's a brilliant book that I often plunder by John Matusiak, I think that's how you pronounce his name, called The Tudors in 100 Objects. If you don't have a copy of it, go out and buy one. There are a couple of sort of really interesting objects that he's got here that are jewels that are connected with sort of magical, sort of superstitious powers. And one is something called a call locket, okay? And call is the membrane that covers a newborn baby's head and face after it's left the mother's womb. It's completely harmless. It's quite rare, but thought to be quite lucky. So it's estimated that only about 80,000, one in 80,000 cases, a baby would be born. And it's often seen as a really, you know, magical, spiritual sort of property. People who are born with it are thought to have had the gifts of second sight or healing. They're called call bearers, and it's thought to safeguard against dangers such as drowning. And this is a time when, you know, life, as we know in the past, having looked at accidents, you know, death was all around. You know, there was illness, disease, medicine was relatively, you know, unadvanced. And so, you know, there were lots of attempts to try and control, you know, people's luck. Sailors, for example, I didn't know whether you knew this, but sailors would often carry pieces of call for potency to protect them from drowning. And the example that they've got in the book is a locket that has a piece of call in it, and it reads on it, John Monson, M-O-N-S-O-N, born the 10th of September at 12 of the clock at night, 1597. Now, being born at 12 o'clock at night is also, you know, is also thought to have importance as well, because it enabled the child in this sort of superstition to see ghosts and spectres. And this is a really amazing jewel. It's a locket made in around 1597 because it's dated. It seems to have this piece of call around it. So the piece of call, the skin that covered this baby, John Monson. And it is made of gold with black enamel. It measures 5 centimetres in height, 3 centimetres in width. So it's a sort of, you know, fair size. And it is of a, you know, fairly wealthy family of non-noble rank. They're a fairly wealthy, middling sort of family. And what it shows is that those kinds of superstitious tendencies were quite prevalent, irrespective of what the church was doing to try and clamp down on them. There was sort of that quite widespread belief in superstition and witchcraft. And we've talked in the past about Keith Thomas's Religion and the Decline of Magic. And that's certainly something that he shows throughout the 16th and 17th century. And this is a time when there was widespread belief in children, you know, falling prey to, you know, witches and fairies coming along and taking them away, spiriting them away out of bed. So, you know, there's a belief in the evil eye, for example, and so there's an attempt to try and, you know, protect people. So it's a really interesting example here of a piece of skin, a piece of caul, tucked into a locket as a form of amulet. Another example that they have, and this is a brilliant example. It exists in, survives in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and it's something called the Danny Jewel. Have you come across the Danny Jewel?
No, never heard of it.
Okay, the Danny Jewel is absolutely incredible, and it is made out of narwhal horn, and it absolutely amazing. They thought that basically it was unicorn horn. It was acquired by the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1917. It was thought to have been made around 1550, and it's in the shape of a ship, and it measures about 8.5 centimetres, and it contains a semicircular section of narwhal's tusk, and it is mounted in gold and suspended on a chain with three sort of large rings, and it belonged to members of the Upper Sussex Gentry family at Danny House, Hurst Pierpoint, in Sussex. And it basically, as I said, they thought that it was a unicorn horn, and it was supposed to protect against poison in food and drink. So it was a sort of, again, it's the way in which these sort of superstitious objects were made in order to protect people. So there we are, Sam. Amulets.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing having something that's not a jewel on a on jewellery, essentially.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
It's a bit of human skin, I suppose. It does make me think about people who have lockets with human hair in.
Ooh, yes. Love a locket.
You've come across that.
Love a locket. Lockets are really interesting because I think they again can have that sort of talismanic power. They're often associated with love, so you'd give a loved one a locket. A locket might have hair or you know, something precious in it, maybe a little love note. Yes, I'd love a locket. Wouldn't you love a locket? Big thing in the 18th century, lockets. People stealing lockets as well.
Oh, that's interesting. They're very personal. I mean, one of the things about the Armada jewellery is it's not... A lot of it is actually not very imaginative, OK? So it's crucifixes, it's big gold chains. And this is me being slightly cynical here, but it's quite an important point to make. Because if you compare it to other types of jewellery... like the Medici jewellery that was given as gifts. This is in late 16th century Florence. That's mind-blowing. And they've got a problem there in that the Medicis are in receipt, incredibly wealthy, and they are in receipt of gifts. But what do you give someone who's basically already got everything? And the answer is that you give them creativity linked with linked with precious metals and jewels. And there are some in the museum, the Florence Museum, just some amazing gifts which were given to them, not least jeweled insects, micro jewels. So you could have got a dragonfly, which is enameled gold with pearl, diamonds, rubies, and silver. You've got a lizard, which is enameled gold with mother of pearl and diamonds. You've got a frog, enameled gold with diamonds and a pearl. So very different from the very simple but very impressive gold chains of of the Spanish Armada. So creativity, I think, is hugely important. And that always comes down to taste as well. But one key point I wanted to talk about was where these jewels come from in jewellery, especially like the really, really fancy stuff. I've mentioned the South American source of the Spanish jewels, but what I thought about was India as a source of jewellery. And I interviewed the historian Will Dalrymple, very famous historian of India. He's written a book fairly recently on the East India Company. And he... In his book, he talked about what happened at the Siege of Lucknow. And this is... There's a defence of a British area within the city from rebel sepoys, who are Indian soldiers in the East India Company. And that all happens during the Indian Rebellion of 1857. And at the end of it, there are descriptions of people carrying away... jewels by the boatload, literally by the boatload, boatloads of precious jewels. So I decided to look into this a bit. And there's some wonderful stuff which has been written by the Siege of Lucknow. And particularly I came across a great description of someone researching the courtesans of Lucknow, very famous courtesans, looking at the female history of what was going on there. Now, these women actually appear in the civic tax ledgers of 1858 to 1877. Classed under the occupational category of dancing and singing girls. Some of them were in the highest tax bracket, so they're the largest individual incomes of anyone in the city. Their names are also listed on lists of property confiscated by British officials from Indians who had proven involvement in the Siege of Lucknow and the subsequent rebellion. There's another list, it's about 20 pages long, records the spoils of war from the siege. And these were seized from one set of female apartments. So this is where the courtesan lived, and it's in the palace and garden complex called the Kaisar Bagh. And these are the courtesans of Wajid Ali Shah. 300 or more consorts were there when it was seized by the British. And it makes you realise quite how remarkable their surroundings were. Gold and silver ornaments studded with precious stones, embroidered cashmere wool and brocade, shawls, bejewelled caps and shoes, silver, gold, jade, amber-handled fly whisks, silver cutlery, jade goblets, plates, spittoons, hookers, silver utensils for serving and storing food and drink, valuable furnishings, and a great deal of remarkable jewellery, which these women wore. And the value of this booty itself was estimated at nearly 4 million rupees in 1857. And there was about 2 rupees to the US dollar in 1857, so maybe $8 million. The whole siege is also interesting because there are descriptions of English women fleeing. And this comes down to this idea of jewellery as a portable source of wealth. This is from a book by Germon, R.C., A Lady's Diary During the Siege of Lucknow. It was published in 1870. I put on 3 of each kind of undergarments, a pink flannel dressing gown and a plaid jacket, and then over all my cloth dress and jacket made out of my habit. I then tied my cashmere shawl round my waist and also Charlie's silver mug, and put on a worsted cap and hat, and had my cloak placed on the saddle. In my pink dressing gown, I stitched dear mamma's last present to me, and I filled several packets with valuables also. In 2 under ones, I also had my little stock of jewellery and my journal and some valuable papers. I also wore a bustle in which I'd stitched my Honiton lace wedding dress, veil and other items, and 2 black and white lace shawls, so that I was a pretty good size. So that's just one example of people escaping from a dangerous situation with jewellery. But all of this, you know, this idea of jewels and warfare does raise a very important question of where do they come from and how should modern nations deal with colonial legacy of looting? it comes back to the point here, India was actually the only source of diamonds in the world until 1725, which is when they discovered diamond mines in Brazil. So if you look at something like the crown jewels, and there are a phenomenal amount of diamonds in the crown jewel, diamonds in particular, then there is a serious legacy there that needs to be addressed. No more so, I suppose, than the Kohinoor diamond, very important Indian diamond. A written description, it first comes into the Mughals' possession in 1628 when Shah Jahan commissioned a magnificent gemstone encrusted throne with a Kohinoor diamond on it. The outside of the canopy was to be of enamel work studded with gems, and inside was to be thickly set with rubies, garnets and other jewels, and it was to be supported by emerald columns. On top of each pillar there were to be two peacocks set with gems, and between each of the two peacocks a tree set with rubies and diamonds, emeralds and pearls. So a remarkable thing, and the Kohinoor was part of that, this enormous, enormous diamond. And it eventually is ceded to Queen Victoria, of course, after the British annexation of the Punjab in 1849. It's then been in a variety of crowns. The crown of Queen Alexandra, wife of Edward VII, the crown of Queen Mary in 1911, and finally the crown of Queen Elizabeth. So this is for the Queen Mum's coronation. So I thought a really interesting thing there, and this whole source of diamonds. I mean, one other point to make about this is best made by the Cullinan diamond, so a much more modern one. We think the Kohinoor was found around the 12th century, so very ancient indeed. But the Cullinan diamond, this comes from a South African diamond mine, and it was found in the early 20th century, around 1907. It was purchased by the Transvaal colony. And given as a gift to the English King Edward VII. Now, the Transvaal government only actually paid 40% of the money that it was valued at, and they wrote the rest off as diamond tax. So there's 60% of it wasn't actually given to the diamond mine. It was purchased for the equivalent of 15 million today. So the people who received that 40% were the owners of the mine, which was founded in 1902. And the surface manager of the mine, a white man, Frederick Wells, he was the one who brought the stone to the general manager. He was cited as discovering it. He received a bonus of £2,000, an enormous amount of money. But the point, of course, is that the workforce of the diamond mines consisted mainly of black migrant workers in the 1880s up to the early 20th century. A lot of descriptions say that the Cullinan diamond, unsurprisingly, was found by one of these unnamed black migrant miners who told Wells of his discovery, handed it over. But this chap, of course, did not receive any bonus at all. So with jewellery, there's, of course, a very, very, very complicated imperial legacy that I think really does need to be addressed.
Oh, that's very important indeed. And I think I'm picking the history of the crown jewels, I think, is a really important issue. I just very briefly want to talk about different kinds of jewellery. You've talked about the gems that are in jewellery, but often it's actually quite simple things that appear in jewels, bones and shells, things like that. And you think about the kinds of jewellery that pendants that the Maoris might have, the use of animal teeth, ivory shells, that Neanderthals might use, for example. And this got me thinking about Native American jewellery. And there's a wonderful book that I picked up at the British Museum by Max Carucci years ago called Ritual and Honour, Warriors of the North American Plains. And it's a brilliant book, and I think it was based on an exhibition, certainly on their collections. There's a wonderful chapter in it called Animal Protection. And what this is about is all the different sort of parts of animals that were absorbed into Native American jewellery, but also their clothing and their costumes that gave them protective power. And I just want to read you this wonderful extract from an Iowa war song. It's me, I am War Eagle. The wind is strong, but I am an eagle. I am not ashamed, no, I am not. The twisting eagle's quill is on my head. I see my enemy below me. I'm an eagle, a war eagle. And the book goes on about, the chapter goes on about how the warriors used different parts of animals, whether they're skins, feathers, hooves, claws. And they saw animals having being sort of supernatural beings and sort of, you know, and having these protective powers. They take parts from foxes, from dogs, from bulls, mosquitoes, buffaloes, for example, and all of these would then be incorporated into weapons, shirts, hair, shields, personal charms, you know, that would basically provide them skill and protection during combat. And the book has a whole range of artifacts, from a shirt made of scalp and ermine, so it's human hair and ermine tissue that was sort of woven together. There's another example of a split horn headdress, which is a beautiful headdress that belonged to the Brave Dog Society of the Blackfoot, which is just a stunning, stunning headdress. Another example is a protective charm, an armband, which is made out of deer hoof and cotton and brass. So it's almost like a bracelet that would be worn around the neck. But the piece that I was going to talk about was a bear claw necklace with a metal star. And this is absolutely amazing. It's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 big bear claws, and then some other beads around it, and then an enormous metal star, and it measures in length about 29 centimetres. So it's almost the size of a ruler, with the width of 26 centimetres. And bear claws, these have a really deep spiritual significance for Plains Indians, because it's associated with the strength and power of bears. The star in itself appears on all sorts of ceremonial robes of various sort of Plains tribes, including the Pawnee and the Blackfoot, and it represents the morning star, which is a really important part of Plains Indians' belief. And you can see it on the decorations on holy man's robes. But this would have been worn, this kind of amulet necklace would have been worn into battle, with the bear claw giving power and strength and protection. So there we are, Sam. We're back to that sort of, back to that idea of necklaces and amulet and protection and spirituality.
I love it. And also the mention of shells and made me think of the brilliant shell money that comes from the Pacific Islands. You can see that in the British Museum. I'd urge you all to go and see it. It's fabulous. Carries. That's it for now, guys. I hope you've enjoyed our little episode on the history of jewellery. I enjoyed it very much, and it made me realise how much more there is for us to do. We could do maybe a separate one on diamonds or shells,
yes,
James.
Yes,
we should do that.
Shells, yeah. Rings.
Fabulous stuff, guys. Thank you very much for listening. Do please follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in maritime and naval history, do please check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast. It's fantastic.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Instagram and Facebook, so come and check us out there. Check out our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, for our back catalogue and also for signed books. And should you wish to support what we're doing, head over to patreon.com and our Histories of the Unexpected page there, and you can become a patron of Histories of the Unexpected and help us change the way in which people think about the past. But meantime, be well, everyone, and take care. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Here we go, guys. Bye-bye.